Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, are you in the studio there?
Hello, testing. We are. We're here.
Hi, Corey.
Hi. Well, Mrs. Future sounds like Mrs. Future, but Dr. Future sounds like robotic.
I was a little worried about that. I was just reading about this quantum teleporter breakthrough, and it's got me very robotic.
Yeah, he's very impressionable when he reads about robots and teleporters.
Yeah. Oh, this is crazy, man. It's a breakthrough on the first ever transfer or teleportation of a particular set of quantum information from one point to another. This opens up the doorway to transmitting huge amounts of information quantumly, like quantum encryption and other forms of information. It's a ways before we'll actually be able to beam our bodies around, but we're starting to do it with information. Isn't that wild?
It is wild. I'm trying to get my brain around it. My brain can't get there yet.
No, it's one of those quantum things.
Your encryption key has not yet been unlocked, Corey.
Yeah.
That's true. I haven't taken the right pill. I'm still taking the blue pill.
Well, they even call the machine that they're doing the experiments on the teleporter. Curiously enough, it's in Tokyo, of all places. The laboratory.
Why would that, of all places?
Yeah.
I think it'd be a good place to have it.
Well, I guess it would be.
I don't know that anybody wants to teleport in, but I'm sure people want to teleport out.
And as they say, necessity is often the mother of invention.
Do you know why Star Trek had a teleporter?
Because it saved them their budget from having to build landing craft and the special effects.
They actually had written into the show landing craft. You're right. They had the little shuttlecraft.
Uh-huh.
And before the first episode aired, they didn't have time to build them. So they had to improvise something very quickly, which was the teleporters.
Yes.
And you're exactly right.
Thank you. Yeah, Star Trek was definitely one of my childhood programs. That, Lost in Space, Time Tunnel.
I know Lost in Space real well, but I don't know Time Tunnel.
Time Tunnel's on Netflix streaming. It was a secret government project that had invented a time-traveling technology. It was a giant tunnel. Kind of like the Stargate series that came much later, only it was traveling through time. Underground base somewhere in Nevada, totally top secret. And they had teams of people lost in time, and they had to try to get them back here. And they kept on getting lost. Every time they tried to beam them out from one time to another, they'd go from, you know, the Civil War to the decks of the Titanic. You know, always a good story. Well, for a while.
Everything's good for a while. So what's going to be on your show today besides streaming media and video and data?
All that kind of good stuff. Well, there's a lot of really cool stuff that's happening for our iPhone, iPad, Android stuff. So we've got a lot of new stories there.
Did you like iPad better than Android, or which one?
Well, right now I like iPad, iPhone the most. That's because I have them. I don't really own an Android, and if I had one, I'd probably like it more. But it's about a generation behind in terms of the quality of the user interface, from what I understand. It's still a little kind of rough around the edges, though the latest versions I hear are really quite good. But initially it was very much like Klingon tech.
Yeah. BlackBerry came out today with their playbook, which looks nice, and it plays Flash and can do more business type of programming.
Yes. Well, meanwhile, the iPhone is coming out with a tri-dimensional 3D scanner. So because they're a little bit ahead of the game, maybe a year ahead, they're actually a year ahead in the apps. Now, some crazy mad scientist programmers have figured out how to use the camera to create a 3D scan of yourself.
And they do face recognition, I've heard.
Face recognition. Of course, I've heard that first came out on Google Goggles, now that I think about it, and that they had to hold back on that because of the personal, I guess, privacy issues that it would spawn. They have that capability where you could literally aim your phone at anybody walking down the street, and it could probably take you to their Facebook page. But now we're not doing that yet because the company is a little afraid of releasing that without some kind of safeguard. That could be an interesting topic just in and of itself, you know, in terms of...
Well, from a policing point of view, if the police have goggles on that, oh, there goes Corey, there goes Michael's whirling, there goes Kay's whirling, they just know everybody walking around, is that not an invasion of their privacy by kind of looking into who they are without their permission?
Yeah, it goes beyond permission at that point. It gives everyone the power of the intelligence agencies at their fingertips. It's the Pandora's out of the box. I don't think we can take it back at this point. So we really are going to look at how we can evolve to handle that kind of freedom rather than trying to restrict it. I don't think we're going to be too successful at restricting.
Jerry Springer was a very successful show, I'm not sure we can. We got 10 seconds left to have a great show. Enjoy yourself. Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, cast of millions upgraded from thousands following this.
Thanks, Corey.
Time now for Dr. Future. on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show with Agent Nada and Mrs. Future.
Hey, KSCO!
Hello out there,
everybody.
Hello. Welcome to the future.
Yeah, for us, the first big future event for the weekend was Future of Gaming Conference on Friday.
Yes, if I remember correctly, Dr. Future, yes. Our guest last week was Noah Wardrop Fruin, who was one of the organizers of the gaming conference. And I think it was a great success. What would you say, Mrs. Future?
Oh, yes. It was quite stimulating, very entertaining, and very interesting to visit the world of the gamers.
Yeah, and it was a great mix of industry people. Will Wright gave the best keynote speech I ever heard. Rod Humble, Will Wright being the Sims creator and Spore creator, one of the biggest game.
Yeah, he's the guy that's really pioneered simulation.
That's right.
In the gaming world. And he gave a very vast speech, covered the history of gaming all the way back for a while, and really looks at what's next. And
Yeah, the gamers taught me something I never realized before, which is as early as World War I, gaming theory was so important to the educated people of the world that they were saying that war is obsolete, that fighting a war could be simulated and thus didn't need to be fought. And, of course, they didn't practice that, but that's when they started looking into it.
The question has been, can we put humanity's anxieties and frustrations and anger into virtual space and leave real space to more fun?
Yeah, right. Don't pollute real space with these crazy ideas that you can simulate in virtual space.
Of course, the gamers might get upset about it. They want to leave the fun in game space. let reality keep its pain.
Well, I think there's a lot more opportunities to let gamers enjoy the fun and simulate the misery in game space than in reality.
So the thing is that gaming looks like it's here to stay. There was a tremendous turnout. It was packed. After all these very stimulating conversations and breakout groups, people were able to socialize with each other, and they formed lots of small circles with very excited people gesticulating to each other and taking each other's pictures and sharing notes. And it's really nice when you have a cross-pollination between two different worlds like that, between the academic perspective of what gaming is and the people that are making games that are successful in the marketplace.
There was another breakthrough
that
happened at
you,
this Malcolm? Conference. There was a line for the women's bathroom. And there was great hooraying in the women's bathroom because most of the women there had been to many game events, game conferences, and been the only woman there. And so the fact that there were so many, and it was a big bathroom.
Yeah. Well, that's now that I see your point.
Lots of girls chatting in there.
It was tremendous. There was women of all ages. I wouldn't say it was half and half.
Yeah.
But it certainly wasn't like, oh, I can't see any women here, because there was women everywhere. It was
so
great.
Let me ask you this then: what was a hot topic for women gamers, and from what you were able to clean?
I thought that the woman on the panel with the final speakers, with Noah, whose name I don't know, but she was one of the most fascinating speakers because she created this description of all of the different kinds of games and how they optimize for either imagination or functionality or
empathy.
Interactivity, empathy.
Which is one of my favorite ideas about gaming, and how do we build empathy with this technology and with this platform. And she was a younger woman I'll get back to that after the break. I'll find her name. She has a game company in Los Angeles.
Is she designing games for both men and women that just contain more emotional content, more feelings? More?
One of the games she was talking about during the question and answer period was about the idea that they were creating this virtual space and people would inhabit the similar world. So you would be in this, like, let's say, meadow, and up coming over the hill are these people, and you talk with them, and then they decide to walk with you or not. And you don't know if these people are avatars or simulated people that the game has created for you, but really they're other people. And so it's...
The remote eyes and ears somewhere.
Exactly. It was really
interesting.
I see.
So you're really taking Skype to another dimension here. Well, it's not just looking at a video picture of someone, but you have an avatar of each other, and you can go walking together in virtual places and talk.
Right. Right.
So you could have your favorite pond or something, or ocean or mountaintop. Do you want to?
Which reminds me of the second keynote speaker was Rod Humble, who is the Second Life creator.
Right.
And now, so he did, after lunch, if you remember correctly, Dr. Future, the after lunch keynote. We had three keynotes, which is interesting because usually I always thought keynote was like one.
Second Life, for the uninitiated, is the virtual world where you can go into on your computer. And you're in a 3D world and you're interacting with what's known as avatars in three-dimensional space.
That's right. And they've created vast lands. You get a plot of land and you can build whatever you want in it in Second Life. It's free. It's a free download. You can fly in Second Life. One of the first things you do is you choose who your avatar looks like and what they're wearing. And
but typically, it hasn't really been a gaming world. That's the interesting thing.
Well, there's casinos in it.
Now it's becoming. Games are being incorporated into it.
And so then you can fly, like I was saying, and you can build your own place. Oh, and you can talk.
And you can hang out with other people there.
That's right.
So the virtual lounge concept is evolving.
Right. And I think I told you the first time I went into Second Life was as a part of team. There was a team meeting with Obama had just been elected, but he still wasn't in office. And so there was a team meeting with Obama about healthcare. And healthcare issues, and they were really doing the outreach to figure out how they could help people the most. And Second Life felt it was very important to give the Second Life perspective, because many people that are in Second Life are people that are possibly wheelchair bound or have some kind of need for this virtual reality.
So it becomes their primary social space.
Exactly. And specifically, autistic people are able to, through this mediated experience, have interactions with other people in Second Life.
Find others that they can share their sensibilities of communication with.
And because there's this a slight delay in mediation, somebody that normally would not be able to connect with other people in real reality can in virtual reality. So there's a great amount of healing that's involved there also. I mean, can you imagine if you're wheelchair-bound and you can go into this place where you can fly around and you can go see different great, you know, Notre Dame in Paris. There's recreations of all the big cities. In fact, a friend of mine is here. He makes machinimas.
Oh, that's where you make movies in these virtual spaces.
That's right. Boy, that cut down on a cost.
Yeah, talking about sets available to you, eh?
Right, and actors.
Wow.
That, I think, is going to be pushing quite a bit in the same direction.
Especially as machinimas start to look photorealistic.
Exactly. And so Draxter, he's here in the area. He's also a musician. He's here from Munich. And so there's a whole recreation of Munich on Second Life.
You can use as a back lot.
That's right. And he goes there, and he goes to the apartment that he grew up in, where his father still lives. And he meets his father with his son in Munich in Second Life. His father's actually in Munich.
Interesting. Wow.
And so he gets to play with his father, gets to play with his son in the apartment that he grew up in. While they're here in Seaside.
In virtual Munich.
And speaking German.
So they might as well be together.
It's incredible.
Wow. So it really collapses the distance. It really gives you some semblance of a very intimate, close experience just through your screen.
That's right.
What I found is that having the CD quality audio makes a difference too, because you feel more like you are in meat space, or meat space being physical presence with each other.
Right. So you talk to somebody and they talk right back to you.
Yeah.
And you hear them.
Just like in meat space.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's better than a phone call because you've got a whole environment and you're engaging as a person through the screen. And so it's more like a window into a world.
Right. And you're meeting in a palace off the island of the coast of Spain.
Right. At least your character is. You yourself may be in your bathrobe or something. But
right. You know. But that's the environment. That's the context.
That's the immersion experience.
That's the immersion, right. Yeah, and so you're there and there's the babbling fountain and the ocean waves, and you're there. And then you can fly. It's one of the most amazing experiences.
It's the closest we have to what we might call a holodeck tech from the Star Trek universe.
Exactly. As this gets more and more, the ability for us, such as one of the news articles we're going to be talking about, this phone app that can take a picture of your face, create a three-dimensional character of that space or the data of that space. You throw that into Second Life, and there's your avatar, looks just like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's a real art to it, to making the experience online satisfying. Yeah.
It's evolving. I mean, nothing is quite as good as really being in the same place at the same time with someone. That is the gold standard. That's the holy grail that virtual space is trying to create. And it's getting there. It'll take another, you know, generation or two before it's totally there. But meanwhile, for example, they use this kind of high-definition interface for the guys who had run the Spirit rover on Mars. And after a day of sitting there in a 3D environment for both sound and visuals, they come out of there, they feel like they were on Mars.
Yeah, yeah. And just think about all the resources we're saving from not having to fly to Mars.
And with gas over $4 a gallon.
Yeah. Right. How much is that jet fuel? How high is that going
to
go?
Start having these experiences together without actually having to go anywhere.
Right. And that's the green revolution, and that's how it is collapsing into the digital media. The new digital media interfaces is, I think, a huge driver in the green economy, because it will be able to save the resources for people to have to fly around the world, and we can be with each other close and be with each other without having to move our bodies.
Yeah, and feel satisfied by it.
Exactly.
See, that's the trick.
Right.
I mean, we often get together to eat, and we might need some kind of virtual restaurant where we're still eating. It looks
Speaking of eating, didn't you do something very interesting? In fact, I think I was there.
Oh, that was the other big event this weekend. Yes, yeah. It was a Santa Cruz event.
Absolutely original. Yeah. I have never thought of or experienced anything like this before.
And what was it, Mrs.
Well,
Future?
Setting. It was called, this event called...
Savor. Savor is the creation of Angela Blessing, who is one of our local treasures here. She is a Renaissance artist in jewelry, music, and food.
In this case,
fashion.
It was an event, and it was an event that involved food and music.
Yes, she created a dinner party for 30 of her friends.
But not just a dinner party in the normal sense. You had to put on a blindfold when you got to the table.
Yes, it was meant to savor your food through all of your senses except your sight. And in order to do that, everyone was seated at a lovely table and then was asked to put on their blindfold. And at that point...
After being serenaded by live musicians with, I think, a bass, a cello, and singers.
Also at this event, we had to use our 10 natural utensils, meaning our fingers, for the food.
Yeah, no utensils made of metal.
Right. And it was very entertaining.
And the food was amazing.
Amazing. So
it was
exquisite.
All chosen very carefully for the tactile, for the sensual, the smell, the feeling of it, the juiciness of some of the foods that she chose. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible, incredible experience.
Very artistic way to eat. Very wonderful.
And I kind of knew it intellectually, but it was there that I really experienced how closely food and sex created the same articulations. You know, the rooms. I didn't know any better. I'd swear I was experiencing somebody having, you know, a great time.
Stay tuned. This is the Dr. Future Show. KSCO Santa Cruz.
Talk to you after the break. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. I wanted to let you folks also know that you can see what we're surfing to in terms of articles by going to kseo.com/drfuture. And that will
take you. That's right. And we're using the Sinecast. So whenever we start talking about a new article, we change that link and you get to follow along.
That's right. And if you want to interact with us, you have several options. One of them is to call us at KSCO, and that is at 831-479-1080. The other ways you can interact with us is through our Twitter feed, which we are updating live during the show at Dr. Future Show on Twitter. And then you can also check out the links directly from our website on the drfutureshow.com webpage on the links page. So lots of ways to play.
Back to the news. We have sent in bots into the nuclear reactors in mass now. We've got several of them.
The one we've been talking about the most, Dr. Future?
The iRobot.
The iRobot. Yeah, they're the company that's been there all along. And?
Well, they've been sent into the inner sanctums of the nuclear reactors to see what's going on. These are the initial ones that are like the scouts. They're checking it out. They're looking at what's the damage, what's going on, basically. Anyway, they got inside. They have tank-like treads on them. They've gone into some inner doors, and two of them are now in the inner sanctum. They are taking readings of radioactivity, of temperature, of oxygen. They're looking at whether or not what these are in relation to what humans can handle for repair. And the initial sensor readings indicate that there's too much radioactivity to allow humans to enter either of the buildings explored so far.
Yes, I wonder how many light years we have to wait until humans can go in that building again.
There's a third building that's being analyzed, and we'll find out soon what's going on there.
Yeah.
So the Brits have sent in some robots as well, the Kinikou robots, and they're primarily going to be used for removing contaminated debris and shielding blocks so that humans will be able to work in there without extended radiation exposure. And even though Japan is a world leader in robotics, the country's robot makers mostly build the stationary industrial machines on assembly lines rather than the mobile rescue or surveillance robots like the Brits and we have.
I can't believe that. They have like the best robot convention in the world. The Japanese robot like industry is hands down the best.
Yeah, but I guess ours were designed for military applications, with treads. And
well, I think that there are very different focus in terms of the Japanese robot industry, which really seems to me to try and emulate humans very much and try and create a robot that can act like a human, whereas these robots that are sent in from the Brits and from the U.S., from the iRobot team, these don't intend to emulate humanity at all. They just are very functional, and they're actually meant to facilitate humans doing remote operations, like being able to repair the plant from far away through seeing what they're doing, having strong robot arms to move things around.
So it's like a little front-end loader on a radio control.
Yeah.
Remember, we talked about this. They had to fix that radio control aspect of it because once they stuck it in there and there was the radiation levels, then the radio didn't work. And so they had to fix that. So obviously a lesson learned.
Right.
Anyway, the PackBots were designed to be the first responders on dirty and dangerous missions, which is this is one. So it's a good test for dirty, dangerous mission robots.
There you go. They're going to set us free. I know it.
Designed to pick up bombs and stuff and look at them and go into dangerous areas and possibly be shot at. So nuclear reactors, nothing compared to having to deal with hand grenades and bullets.
Speaking of radioactive contamination.
Yes.
There's an article that you brought up, Dr. Future, about the North Carolina state has developed a material to remove radioactive contaminants from drinking water.
Yeah, I put that in there because I wanted to let everyone know that there is research going on to how we can handle radiation. It's not something that is a unidimensional phenomenon. It's something that people have been thinking about for a while. There are creatures that can eat radiation, certain forms of fungus.
Yes, and earthworms.
And earthworms,
Earthworms are tremendous. They eat it and then they poo it. It's not there. Where'd it go? I want to know.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be really great to get some kind of a simple science explanation of how radioactivity is neutralized.
Well, supposedly right now Chernobyl has the largest, densest population of earthworms. Like ever since the explosion back in the 80s, the earthworms have been just...
Eating it up.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping they're doing it for us.
Well, that's another thing. I'm glad you mentioned Chernobyl because a number of people have been comparing the Fukushima and Chernobyl because they both are on the same level on the disaster scale. And yet they're very different disasters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So explain that to us. How is it that they're on the same level, but they're very different?
Well, what's similar is that a level 7 accident is a major release of radioactive material with widespread health and environmental effects, and that requires the people there to implement countermeasures. And that's basically a level 7. And both the plants meet that criteria. Fukushima requires a huge cleanup effort, and the international community is still working today for Chernobyl as well. It's still being cleaned up. So the Fukushima also qualifies by the numbers. Japanese estimate, for example, that the reactors have released between 370,000 and 630,000 terabecquerels of radioactive material. And that's far more than the equivalent of tens of thousands of terabecquerels of iodine-131. That's the cutoff for what's considered to be a level 7 accident. The release of the radiation then definitely qualifies them both for that. And they even think that they'll probably exceed Chernobyl ultimately. But what's different between Fukushima and Chernobyl is that Fukushima reactors have containment structures. They have an extra layer of safety that's helped limit the spread of radioactivity, while Chernobyl had been exposed to the open, you know, had no containment structure. You also got to look at the conditions under which these accidents happened, which were very different. The Fukushima reactor shut down after the quake and then overheated because of the cooling system failure. The Chernobyl reactor, on the other hand, was still running when it exploded, which caused a much larger release of heat. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing is that the Chernobyl reactor was a full core meltdown, while the Fukushima is a partial meltdown.
Possible partial meltdown. They're still analyzing.
Yes, Mrs. Future. A possible Marshall.
Ever the optimist.
And the other thing is that Chernobyl happened a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it spewed debris and radioactive materials all over the place. And it sparked a fire that just burned for days. And the surroundings just had to be evacuated almost immediately, within hours. At Fukushima, the reactors had been releasing radiation constantly, but at a much slower rate,
mm-hmm.
as far as we know.
And less.
Yeah, about a tenth as much. So far, there was a head of the medical team, Dr. Robert Peter Gale at Chernobyl. He estimated that if the situation doesn't worsen, the Fukushima accident would cause fewer excess cancer cases than Chernobyl, because Chernobyl officially resulted in about 6,000 cases of thyroid than the norm. Well, Fukushima, they think right now, will maybe lead to just a few additional thyroid cancer cases, maybe 200 to 1,500 total additional cancer cases over the next half century. So Chernobyl is much worse then. Plus the precautions in Japan, including the monitoring of the food and the water supplies and the iodine tablets, that will probably lessen the severity of the health effects consistently too.
We're comparing death by, you know, death by hanging and death by asphyxiation or something. It's still death.
Much less, though. I think you'll see a considerably less death from this, unless something goes wrong, unless there is a total core meltdown or something happens that hasn't happened yet. Okay, so the conspiracy theorists think there's a lot of cover-up on this, that there's actually a military research experiments going on in nuclear bomb development in the civilian systems on Japan, and that that's been tipped in a bad direction. But who knows? That's just speculation. I'd say if we base it on what the main media has told us, then there's not a lot to worry about, at least over here.
Yeah, well, I think it's really in the trend of thinking, like, how much damage do we have to do with a very vastly complex and barely understood technology, and how many people have to absorb the effects of these miscalculations on the part of the few before we change the way that we decide to do these things.
Design it differently?
Well, I think that the people who believe in nuclear power design it as best they can. They really believe that nuclear power is safe, that humans understand it well enough to design it safely. Then they really push the edge, you know, and then to the best of their expectations, they've covered all the bases, and then something comes up that they didn't anticipate. It's like, do we have the right criteria for making these decisions?
Right. Well, I think that's a very valid point, that we really have to look at how things are designed and what are the criteria in which that design is motivated by.
And should the potential for the level of harm that is caused to so many people be a factor that causes us to not do it?
Yeah. Look, if you play it too safe, you never have innovation. You know, we never would have invented this stuff if we were playing it safe.
Well, do you...
The cat's out of the bag now. It's like privacy and bandwidth. Radioactivity's out as well. We got to deal with it. There are a lot of ways to deal with it, a lot of ways to understand what's going on, how it works, how it affects the biology. By studying it in depth, because we have to, we'll actually learn way more about this than if we just took our time plodding through it in the normal way of understanding reality that humanity is so accustomed to.
So you believe in it's better to get forgiveness than permission and treat this accident as an opportunity for learning rather than admission of
heck
a mistake.
Yeah, well, I think it's fine to admit that things could have been better, but they had triple redundancy. They had no idea a 9.0 earthquake plus a tsunami was going to hit. That's pretty significant, and to design safety for that level of protection is insanely complicated. Yeah, I think they can be forgiven for that. You know, they did the best they could given what they knew and the restraints that they had on them. Yeah, I think we just need to go forward for this.
I think time will tell.
Absolutely.
People feel that it was a forgivable
decision.
Well,
that's what I feel, but what do you think? You know, am I going overboard with this?
Give us a call here at 479-1080.
I don't think so. Things happen. If we don't take any chances, nothing would happen. Reality is dangerous.
There you go. That's true. I agree with that.
You know, if we don't explore it, we'll never get off this planet.
Yeah, well,
this is a training grounds, training wheels.
I think fundamentally I do believe that our reach should exceed our grasp. Isn't that how that cliche goes? You want to aim for things that are beyond your ability to attain them so that you stretch your wings and grow.
Oh, great. Good. Words to live by after this quick break. All right.
Okay.
Stay tuned. We're back.
Welcome back. Yes. Before I mention these cool apps that I've discovered this weekend, I wanted to mention another interesting tech breakthrough with the Libyan rebels, one of our other ongoing recurring themes here. Apparently, they have restored cell phone access with some rather interesting technical acumen. There was a telecom executive, Osama Abushgar, who was on a plane heading back to Abu Dhabi trying to do a humanitarian trip to Libya. And what he found when he was in Tripoli, that communications was impossible with the eastern part of the country. And within Tripoli, the communications was seriously restricted because all network traffic had to go through a central office where I guess they were tapping and doing intelligence gathering on the phone. So he was thinking, well, you know, this is a greatly bad way to try to get humanitarian aid to a country. So he and a team of 7 engineers and several million dollars worth of telecom equipment provided by the United Arab Emirates and Qatar were smuggled across the Egyptian border to the city of Benghazi, the Rebel Alliance headquarters. And there the team incorporated their equipment into their phone network, and they cut off Tripoli. And they used a captured database of phone numbers. They patched users into that service, and they dubbed the new network called Free Libyana. And Free Libyana calls were then routed through a satellite feeds, thanks to the United Arab Emirates, a company called Etisalat, Etisalat, a UAE-run telecom company. Then calls were made for free now across the rebel-held eastern Libya. Free local calls. You need prepaid calling cards for long distance, but what they're looking for is hopefully a billing system soon. At the moment, all domestic calls are free. So that's how they're able to communicate.
Dr. Future.
Yes.
We have a phone call.
Okay.
We've got Vern from SoCal.
Oh, well, great.
Welcome, Vern.
Hey, Vern.
Hi, Vern.
I always know when I hear the fit. I'm with Dr. Future on the challenges of mankind and the technology. In the, you know, if you don't take risks, nothing happens. Plus, the reactors that are coming out these days, that technology's changed a lot with the pebble bed reactors, which is beyond the scope of this phone call.
Oh, great. You know, Vern, you're usually a much better connection. You're a little hard to understand today.
That's because my hands-on phone is my wife holding the your cell phone up so I don't get a ticket.
Well, good for you.
Try to do it. The second thing is, have you seen Robonaut?
Robonaut?
Yes.
No. What's Robonaut?
Robonaut is the NASA robot. Look it up in the studio right there for people that can see your screen. Even though it doesn't look like the beautiful human robots the Japanese make, mm-hmm. it looks like C-3PO with articulated fingers and really cool stuff. It actually looks like a centaur because its base is on wheels.
Oh. Okay, and that's Robonaut, like R-O-B-O-N-A-U-T.
N-A-U-G-H-T, I think, like astronaut.
No, it's N-A-U-T. I'm looking at it right now. I'm at the NASA site.
Is that cool or what?
Yeah, it is super cool. I'm putting it up on the Sinocast. Thank you so much, Vernon.
Not only that, it's got the scanner so it can look at dials. There are videos of its fingers flipping switches. It's really quite cool. And with that, I'll wait till I get a better connection for my next call.
Great. Thanks a lot, thanks, Vernon.
Yeah.
Thank your wife, too.
Thanks for checking in.
It's very cool. Thank you, Vernon, for sending that to us. It's
Robonaut.
I didn't quite hear the first part of the conversation. Was he agreeing with me or not?
Yes, he absolutely says we should dream and explore and worry about the consequences when we have real results.
I know this is a radical perspective to take in a town like Santa Cruz, but in terms of new services, I just have to mention that Sony has fired a shot across the bow today towards Netflix.
Oh, what does that look like?
Well, it's a new service that allows you to stream over your iPhone, iPad without costing anything.
Free streaming.
Yeah, free streaming of a lot of big time movies.
I just made a contract and I'm not getting free streaming.
Who did you make a contract with?
Well, who do you think?
Netflix?
AT&T?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. For your iPad streaming.
Oh, 2 years.
You'll be using that bandwidth up real fast.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, if you're at home on your Wi-Fi, you should be a little bit better.
I am.
So their new service just came out today. Taylor Barcroft just told me about that. Thank you, Taylor. It's called Crackle at the App Store. I like Snap, Crackle, Pop. It's like a crackle.
And what's Crackle going to do for me, Dr. Feature?
It's going to give you more media to absorb.
Oh, that's just what I need.
Yeah, just what you need, more streaming.
More information.
It's not interactive. It's not like the new YouTube service that's coming out. This is more about Sony movies. They've got some classics on there. They had Easy Rider. They've got some old Columbia Pictures properties. They've got newer stuff. I think the Da Vinci Code is on there now.
Looking at the Da Vinci Code. It looked really good,
Yeah, and you were using Wi-Fi. Standard Wi-Fi,
yeah,
exactly. Crackle. It's free. Check it out if you like to stream movies in your car, especially. In the back seat, keep the kids busy.
Oh.
Might be good.
Yeah.
You know? No contract needed with Netflix.
Anybody.
Sony Crackle in the App Store.
Stream movies and television shows over Wi-Fi or 3G.
So they're playing on the power of free to get started.
Yeah. Okay. I'd be there before you got to pay.
Meanwhile, YouTube has put out a new service that allows you to stream from them, kind of like what Ustream does, but it's not available to everyone just yet. And time will tell.
Now, Dr. Future, could you please tell the audience what streaming means? Because I, myself, I thought I was pretty clear on the concept, and then I realized that the way that they're using it now is not exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, the streaming is where you don't have to do a download, where basically you have enough bandwidth to be able to watch the movie in real time, and you don't actually have a copy of it. This copy stays on the server. The streaming companies like that because then there's not a whole bunch of bootleg copies floating around in the world.
And that's basically how Netflix Instant works.
Yeah, Netflix Instant is like that. And YouTube is like that. You don't get a download on YouTube unless you steal it. Unless you go to keepvid.com.
Actually, there's a Mozilla app.
Is there?
It's a free Mozilla app that will grab any movie and download it to your desktop.
All right, so the secret for downloading is out.
It's pretty darn out. Yeah. And, you know, I looked for 2 years on how to grab those.
2 years, huh?
2 years I looked. Oh. 3! And then there it is, Mozilla free app.
Yeah, Or go to keepvid.com. You just go to the, drop in the URL for the movie you want a copy of in Africa.
So the idea here is there's a difference between downloading, where you wait until the whole file arrives.
Exactly.
And streaming, where you say, just play it and let me watch it. And typically, it maybe it'll be a little pixelated, but you'll get it in real time.
Right. So, like, another way you could think about it is you got the garden hose, you turn on the water is streaming through the hose. You let the water go into a water pitcher,
an aquarium,
and it saves the water for you to a container in which you can use the water.
This is more like all you can drink.
Yeah. So we got another phone call, Dr. Future. This is Dave from Salinas. Welcome, Dave.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Future.
Hey, Dave.
Good hearing from you guys. I was thinking about having to make apps, and I was wondering what you suggest on how to make an app. I do photography, and I thought, well, it would be neat to do a little app of like a tour of Carmel Valley or something like that.
Well, how much of a programmer are you?
Not much at all. I know how to do HTML pages. That's about it.
Huh. Well, you might have to team up with an iPhone programmer then, somebody who can do that, because there's a lot to know in being able to do a decent app. If you just want to do an informational type piece, maybe with just photographs and pictures, there are a number of apps that are coming out to help you with that process of like designing a magazine. Adobe is one of the leaders in that.
Okay.
Yeah, they have a, what's their new package, Sonia?
It wasn't Flipbook. Which one?
Well, Adobe has a development package for creating content. I'll have to check to see what the name of it is, but.
Okay, does Apple have any type of software or a website where you can build an app?
They do. It's for programmers. Let's see, there's several sophistication levels if you're working with Apple. Probably a good place to start is to just get involved with the Apple iWeb package, because if you publish using their templates to the web, it's very easy to kind of use all of the Apple tools to then reach the larger audience.
To get it on a mobile platform.
Right. So.
Okay.
Also, to do a Google search on how to build an iPhone app, and you'll find some several resources there.
But basically, you have to learn C++ programming.
No. Actually, they have a lot of tutorials, and you get the Apple, it's called the SDK, the developer kit.
Oh, yeah.
It typically is something that programmers pick up, but one of the beauties of it is that they use a very simplified way of doing programming, and they have a lot of sort of templates and libraries of things that work for you to use. So if you're willing to study it, and there's a lot of tutorials available, you might find that you like trying to become an app developer.
Okay, and how do you, well, then I have to figure out how to get it on the
iPhone store,
iPhone
the App Store, right?
Yeah,
it's a good idea to have somebody who knows about this stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely something that's a pretty programmer-centric world of knowledge.
Okay.
We did run into someone. We were at a venture capital gathering last weekend where there was somebody in Florida who was helping people connect with iPhone app developers for the kind of thing that you wanted.
Oh, yeah, Blue Whale. I think it was BlueWhale.com, BlueWhale.net, something like that.
Okay.
That is a whole network of app developers. So what that is, if you connect with Blue Whale, they will ask you to spec your job, and then they'll put it out for bid so that you can have a number of free estimates on what it would take for someone to do that for you.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a start.
And feel free to send me an email about this. I'll be happy to send you some links in email if you like. And I'm at future@kseo.com. Just future@kseo.com.
Great. Thank you, guys.
All right.
Sure. Good luck with that.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, create your own app. Yeah. Well, that's cool, especially these days where apps can do just about anything and people want to start translating whatever they know into something that can hopefully earn them some money.
Hey, tell us about one of those apps that we alluded to earlier that takes a three-dimensional map of your face.
Yeah, it's the new tri-dimensional 3D scanner for the iPhone.
Agent Nada, have you downloaded that already?
I haven't downloaded it yet. I can't wait, though.
This is interesting. It's the world's first 3D scanner for the iPhone, and it instantly captures 3D models of yourself or your friends or family or anybody, really. Probably your dog. And it uses both the screen and the front-facing camera to detect patterns of light that reflect off your face to build the model. So it creates a real 3D model from reflected light off your face of the camera. Another fine example of computational photography.
It's called Trimensional, Trimensional, the 3D scanner for the iPhone. Mm-hmm. Boy, it's really cool looking.
It's very clever because mainly it wants you to turn off all the lights and then turn your iPhone up to maximum brightness and then point it at your face or whatever it is that you want to take a picture of. And the way that the light reflects off of the object will be turned into a 3D map.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's only 99 cents.
And worth every penny.
Worth every penny.
Now remember, the 3D avatars first came out when the 3D avatars worlds were being released in the mid-90s. And I remember there was a 3D avatar photo booth that you could go to, and you'd sit in there, and then the 3D scanner would go around your head and shoot you and create a 3D image for you to put into virtual worlds.
Yeah. Right. And then they started taking it and putting it in the middle of plastic blocks. And so you could have a three-dimensional picture in the middle of this clear plastic thing. You know what I'm talking about.
A mannequin head.
Yes. I had to do that about 5 years ago. We were in Las Vegas, my girlfriend and I, and it was one of those things on the street, and it just happened to be my wedding anniversary.
Oh, man.
So I thought, hey, what better thing to buy my husband? So I got this.
A 3D head.
A 3D head. And I even got the rotating light presenter. So you put it on this thing, and it rotates, and it shines a light up through it. And
oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, I had never seen anything like it.
And so did you give that to your husband for your anniversary?
It's in his office at Intel.
That is really cool. I would like to see that.
Sounds like something appreciated by those in Nerdland.
Are you calling me a nerd?
No.
I think you're calling me a nerd.
Appreciated by those in Nerdland.
Hey, luckily my husband's a nerd too.
Yeah, so there you go. But that's my point. Hey, you gave it to him, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, with his friends.
And where does it live? At Intel.
It did not.
And what's Intel? Nerdland.
I would say at least you are a nerd lover, okay?
I'm a bit of a nerd. I'll admit it. It's okay. It's taken me 45 years, but I can,
fully
embrace
inner nerd.
Embracing your nerd is why I insisted you download this other eye app this morning.
Yes, which I did.
Yeah.
And tell us about that one, Dr. Future.
This one has been in development for a long time on other platforms, and it's called Photosynth. And it comes from Microsoft, the evil giant to the north. They have some good redeeming value on occasion, and this is one of them.
That's good.
Yeah. Photosynth is awesome, and it makes it really easy to do panorama pictures, including, I believe, all the way to 3D, where you can just go around with your camera and shot. And I've used AutoStitch. I've used a lot of other these. Basically, the idea is that you can do a large picture of your environment, and it will stitch together separate pictures into one giant picture. And what this one is really great about it is that it stitches, not only stitches it well, not only captures it effortlessly, but then allows you to then pan and zoom in a 360-degree circle with your picture.
It's amazing. You did one right before we came on the radio show. You did it of the station
here. In the station here, right.
Yeah, I think it'd be great if you could put that up on your...
I will post it on the new Dr. Future site on Facebook.
Yes.
Thanks to you,
Agent Mata. Dr. Future Facebook page.
Right.
What's that about?
Well, you know, you tell me, you put it up.
Listen, folks, KSCO, we need to get 25 people to like the Dr. Future page so we can get a Facebook URL.
And
so
we'll tell you more after the break.
Go to Facebook if you're there right now and
search for Dr. Future.
The Dr. Future. It's a Dr. Future page. It's a news personality. And give us a thumbs up. That's what we need.
Thank you, Agent Nona.
Oh, my pleasure.
Appreciate that.
I felt it was missing. The world wasn't
right. We needed to be on Facebook.
Yeah, where's the Dr. Future Facebook page?
Oh, really?
Well, we changed that. Stay tuned. KSCO Santa Cruz.
3 o'clock this Tuesday afternoon, the 19th day of April, as we return to Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. Welcome back, folks, to the second hour of Dr. Future. We have a few more news stories, and we have our guest coming in. One of the, I think, most prolific inventors of Silicon Valley that I've ever met.
Woohoo! And what's their name?
Chuck Colby, C-O-L-B-Y. We have a link at our links page, drfeatureshow.com/links, and you can check some of what we're going to be talking about.
And I'll throw it up on the Sinecast. So yeah. You can just go to ksco.com/Dr. Feature.
And there's a lot of stories I'm not able to get to because of the timing on the links site as well. So, like, for example, are the iPhones and the Androids murdering point-and-shoot cameras? It's a big topic these days.
Well, yes, they are.
Not only can they take pictures, but they're also connected to the net, and they allow you to post your pictures.
So why would I take a point-and-shoot when I could take the picture and immediately send it?
Well, I have a very good article about this that was just done, and the interesting thing is that sales of still cameras have gone up 10% over the last year. So people are still buying still cameras in mass. They're not going away.
Yeah, but as soon as those cameras can reach the sophistication and the ability to take beautiful pictures like some of the point-and-shoots, there's still a big difference between what telephones cameras have. Although I hear that Android has a much better telephone.
The iPhone 4 is a lot better than the iPad 2 cameras, for example.
Really?
Yeah. They're both rated as 720p, but it has more quality lens to it.
You want to be a little more articulate about that?
Well, 141 million units were sold last year of still cameras alone because people buy them because they have better lenses. They have better quality imagery than what the tiny point and shoots, even the iPhone 4.
But as that changes so quickly, let's say within 6 months, a year?
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, digital SLRs, those lenses are awesome. And the size of the chip that collects the image is way bigger than what they could fit in a small phone. So there's still going to be a lot of that quality that you just can't get with the small phone. But the fact is that we don't really need quality for most of the stuff that we're shooting. We just need a decent picture to put on Facebook of our friends at a party or us at a beautiful spot in the world. Or these new capabilities of doing panoramas on the camera and then instantly post them. You sort of shoot it and forget it. And you don't have to have a slideshow for your friends when you come back from vacation. They've already been there by the time you get home, which is...
On your Facebook page.
On your Facebook page, right. So all this sort of stuff really speaks well for the phone. And perhaps is the reason why Cisco let go of flip cameras. You know, flip cameras are now dying.
Sad.
They're going out. You can get a great deal on them online. However, who needs a still camera anymore? Or at least a point and shoot. The low-end cameras might as well not have one. I mean, if you're going to do serious photography, that's another matter. Get a Canon Mark II 5D. That kind of investment is well understood. But for everyday type shooting, why not? And so I think that's what's happening to the market. You're going to start to see that.
Oh, I just wanted to update you, Dr. Feature.
What's that?
While we were at the break, I downloaded Transmensional.
Oh, you did?
Yes,
did you?
Yes, I can't wait to play with that.
Oh, good.
Okay. Need to get to a dark room.
We're going to start having to post some of our pictures on the Dr. Feature side, the way things are going here.
Definitely.
When the iPhone came out with the 3GS capability, that was the first one that did movies, we saw a dramatic spike in mobile uploads to YouTube every day, exponentially.
And it turns out that now iPhone is taking over the number one spot as the most used camera for Flickr, which is, you know, a photo upload site.
Gotta love Flickr.
And I got to say, as someone who's carried a camera every day, for the last 25 years.
40 years?
Yeah, since 1987. Camcorder, anyway. I actually carry my camcorder less now when I have my iPhone with me, even though I still have it packed and ready to go. And
ooh.
It's still... And also the voice recorder. I always carry a voice recorder with me as a journalist. It's always handy to have. And I find that the iPhone built-in one is good for many occasions. So I personally experienced this transition from dedicated devices to apps on the iPhone.
So the all-in-one.
Yeah. So definitely interesting. The other thing I wanted to mention was the Allen Institute for Brain Science has a first comprehensive brain map that's come out. Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, who you may have seen on 60 Minutes last Sunday night, his Institute of Brain Science has released the first anatomically and genomically comprehensive human brain map. And it shows you a lot about what goes on in the brain. Like, for example, that 94% of all human brains are strikingly similar. And this established strong patterns for a critical foundation for clinical research. And also data from the two human brains that were completely scanned indicate that 82% of all human genes are expressed in the brain.
Wow.
Yeah, and shows you that genetic blueprint is really connected to the brain. And up until now, we just didn't have this kind of detail. It just didn't exist. They have a system of navigating through this 3D brain. It's similar to our GPS system, but applied for due neuroscience. And you can explore that by, again, the AllenInstitute.org. Go there directly, or just go to our links page, and we'll take you there.
So this is a nice segue for one of the news is that Microsoft adds Kinect support for Netflix, which I think is really exciting.
That is interesting. So what does this mean for remotes, Agent Nada?
It means you won't be losing your remote no more because it's going to be attached to the back of your head.
Really? You mean I'll be able to change channels with my brain?
Yes, just thinking about it.
Well, with Kinect? I didn't know Kinect was a brain EEG machine.
I'm getting this confused with another article here on
yeah. a new headset that allows you to...
I'm jumping ahead of myself.
Okay, let's go back to... from my understanding, the Kinect is more like the Wii where...
It's gestural. So all you gotta do is gesture at your Netflix, and you can choose which movie you want to see streamed into your moment, your Netflix Live.
So you wave your hand and it changes the channel.
It gives you the different content choices. Once you've got the movie started, you can make it rewind just by gesturing with your hand. Yes. And then you can make it go forward or stop.
I could just see the kids on the couch now. It says, Mommy, Bobby hit me. It says, I didn't hit her. I was changing the channel.
That's right. Oh, we were talking about how this might be a whole new slew of emergency room accidents. Is people just trying to download their Netflix movie and smacking their heads in the wall or their hands
on the couch. What could a gesture language accident look like?
That's right.
How could this happen? You're moving your hands around? It's gotten us a lot of good things, but occasionally something goes wrong.
The other project that I was talking about.
Enlighten us about this brainwave control thing.
It's a device that you put on the back of your head, and it monitors your brain signals. And depending on what brainwaves are picked up by the system, it's called MindPlay, M-Y-N-D, Play system. Mm-hmm. And depending on the different states of your mind, the readings of which this MindPlay controller headset picks up, it changes the direction of the film. You have a film that has various possible endings, and depending on how your brain waves
are interpreted
expressing by their different states in the mind, the story will change.
So interactive movies start to become real based on your brainwave activity.
Exactly. It's incredible. This is a whole new level that's been achieved here because, again, it's...
So if you're in a mood for a drama, it'll pick that up and play you a dramatic comedy.
I don't know how it works. Yeah. But they're using this EEG gram, and you put it on the back of your neck, and it picks it up. We've talked about this with game controllers from Emotive, another San Francisco-based...
that's the thing. These things are leaving the realm of neuroscience and entering the game worlds.
Right. And I know with the Emotive headset that also uses EEG gram data, it also was developed for paraplegics. Mm-hmm. So it was a medical thing.
So it allows you to be more fully immersive and fully functional in these worlds, even though you don't have a full body. Great. Okay, well, listen, we're going to take a break now and bring up our guest, Chuck Colby.
Inventor. Chuck Colby.
Extraordinaire.
Hey, stay tuned, KSCO. Having fun?
See you shortly. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Next, we have a guest, Chuck Colby, who is a Silicon Valley inventor and innovator. He's one of the industry's prime innovators. You can read about him in Popular Electronics Magazine. June 97 had an article on him. And he's created many firsts in the computer world and the video industries. He was awarded the top 10 of the show for the National Association of Broadcasters for the first MPEG-1 digital video recorder, the DR3000, back in 94. And won again in 96 with the first MPEG-2. So he's deeply into video as well as many other areas in the computer industry. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Great to have you on the Dr. Future. We've got Sun on with us as well as Agent Otta.
Hi, Chuck.
Yeah, hi there.
I just want to let everybody know that your last name is spelled C-O-L-B-Y, and you have ChuckColby.com.
Right. Yeah, that's my personal website, ChuckColby.com, and then my business one is ColbySystems.com.
Ah, and it's funny because your profile is on the DigiBarn website.
They have a bunch of pictures of things from DigiBarn, and I know that you guys were instrumental in starting DigiBarn, so that's great.
That's Dr. Future.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I believe you had the first portable Mac that came out.
The first portable DOS machine, and I am also the first portable Mac and the first battery-powered portable Mac with an LCD screen, and the first of hundreds of things, mm-hmm. of which about 50 are on that website.
Right,
ChuckColby.com.
Right, yeah.
Going back to 1952.
Yeah. Wow.
I brought you on partially because not only have you done stuff for back then, quite amazing things in the 80s and 90s, but you continue to do so, even to this day. When we went to your latest website, you had a whole host of items for the iPad 2 and the iPhone that I wish I had seen at Macworld.
Well, I probably didn't have them invented by then. I've been inventing an iPhone or iPad thing almost every day. The latest one yesterday is a iPhone holder that holds the iPhone and has provisions for some LED lights on it. And the reason I made that is there was a company at NAB last week that had something similar that they sold for $100. So I looked at that and said, I can make that for $5. I'll sell it for $25, not $100.
Now, what does it do exactly, Chuck?
When you use your iPhone to take a picture, you always seem to get your finger over the lens or not be able to push the button or whatever.
Yeah.
So this has a handle on the bottom, and it holds the iPhone in a horizontal position, or vertical, actually. And so you can point and click either still picture or movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has two versions of LED lamps. One of them is a...
Is it for the camera light? Or?
Well, they're camera lights, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And, you know, the iPhone 4 has a built-in LED, but it's not very strong. So I've come up with a little add-on light bar that sells for $25 that goes on the bottom of it. And then, of course, you can buy the bigger LED light systems that are $200 and $300 that are 6 inches and 8 inches square,
mm-hmm.
which put out a lot of light but are pretty expensive. So this unit holds both my little $25 light bar and it'll hold the $200 light bar above it.
Wow. So what did you go to NAB for? What product were you showing off?
Oh, well, that was mainly for the teleprompter for the iPad and the iPhone.
Oh, right, for the teleprompter. What's the teleprompter for the uninitiated?
Well, I made, the website that I started last month called iPadandiPhoneStuff.com has about 15 things on it that I mm-hmm. invented for the iPhone and iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to make a video to explain a couple of them. So I started to make the video, and I was using the iPhone as a prompter with the iPhone taped underneath the camera lens. Well, and looking at the video, you can really tell that you're not looking into the camera lens. It's really obvious, even if the iPhone is only a couple inches below the lens. So I whipped up this little teleprompter using the first one was an iPhone one, which is the whole teleprompter is about 4 by 3 by 5 inches.
Now, teleprompter, that's what Obama uses, newscaster uses.
TV station, everybody that's on the air, that purpose of it is you can shoot the camera lens through this silvered mirror that has a 30-70 reflection.
And it looks like you're talking. And
it looks like you're looking right into the lens. Well, you are looking into the lens, but there's a cover over it, this piece of half-silver glass that reflects whatever LCD or iPhone is down below so you can read the text.
Uh-huh. And you found that in that world of teleprompter science,
yeah,
it was very expensive,
right? Teleprompters for years, and they are $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. And you know, if you're just using it occasionally, that's pretty expensive.
Yeah, and I had seen some apps for the teleprompting on iPhones and iPads. So.
Yeah, there's one called ProPrompter, which is really quite nice, and it's only $10.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have both an iPhone and an iPad, you can put it on both, so it's really only $5 per unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it lets you remotely control the iPhone or iPad from the other iPhone or iPad via Bluetooth. So
that is cool. I have used that. Now, folks, that the value of the remote control is that you can control the speed of the text that you're reading out loud.
That's right. You can go forward, backward, you can jump, and you can stop it, and you can start it and control the speed. And so anybody within 30 feet can have control of that. So that's really nice.
So you came in with a major price difference.
Well, yeah. The ones, if you do a Google search for iPad teleprompters, the cheapest one is $799, and the cheapest one at NAB, there was three of them at NAB, the cheapest one was that one, $799. There was one for $899. There was one for $1,099.
Well, folks, NAB is the National Association of Broadcasters.
That's the biggest video show now in the world with Condex and a couple other video shows going away.
It used to be CES.
National Association of Broadcasters, 40,000 people for 35, 40 years.
And anybody in the media world goes there.
And now it's up to 120,000 people. So it's a big show. The second biggest show, I think, in Las Vegas.
Uh-huh. So do you showed yours for $199? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I have the only iPhone teleprompter for
$139.
And then I have an iPad one for $199. And they're both on that iPad and iPhone stuff.com.
And everybody else is out there with $7.99.
Yeah, $7.99. And
so what kind of reception did you get?
I got unbelievable reception, and people just couldn't believe it. How can this be $200 and everybody else is $800? Well, it's just designed differently. It's a completely different design than anybody else's, so it can be made a lot lower cost. And it also is completely enclosed. The glass is enclosed. Everybody else's. The glass is kind of like requires a $300, $400 case when you carry it around because the glass is exposed. So mine is all enclosed, so you can put it in a cardboard box and carry it around without breaking anything.
Wow.
So that was kind of neat. And then I had the other product called Video Modem. Now, this is a product that I've had for 20 years. And 20 years ago, it cost $40,000 and was the size of a bread box. And in fact, at NAB this year, there was four other companies that had a similar. What it does is compress video and audio and sends it through the cell system back to wherever you want it to go.
Well, doesn't the phones do that automatically? I mean, you send a MPEG-4 compressed
audio? Yeah, but you can't plug a camera into an iPhone. You have to use the camera that's in there, and people in the broadcast industry want to use their $10,000 cameras.
Oh, I got you. So you can plug in.
So you can plug any video source into this little box that's the size of a big pack of cigarettes and send it through the
cell phone network.
The cell phone system.
Either the
3G or 4G, get better throughput through 4G by three, four times. But if you only have 3G, it'll also work at a lower resolution. But this is the only one that was full 1080p high def at the show. And it was half the price of anybody else's and a tenth the size of anybody else's.
And is this something you came out with 10 years ago, is that what you said?
Well, 20 years ago, 20 the years first ago. Video modem, which was it was called the DR3000, which was the first MPEG-1 video recorder, which also could be used to send video through satellites or the cell system, and that was what the CIA used to bring video from Bosnia back to the Pentagon in 1991.
Yeah. Well, it looks to me like everyone's going streaming now with Sony coming online today and YouTube deciding to go consumer with their streaming content.
Well, that's what this box does. It compresses the video and audio and streams it out through the cell system to the Internet. And then you can go on the Internet anywhere in the world with the right password and download it and have it live video. That's about a second delay by the time it gets encoded and goes through. But that's fine because most reporters in the news business are used to 4 or 5 second delay through a satellite system. So 1 second is fine. Right.
That's on your website too?
That's on ColbySystems.com. It's not an iPad, iPhone.
It's a more expensive thing, I gather.
Yeah, it's on the first page of Colby Systems.
Yeah, what does something like that cost, $1,000 or?
$9,000. Well, everybody else is $30,000, $40,000.
Oh, I see. So you really are. This is the professional broadcaster world here. Okay.
Right. Yeah,
I was getting exciting there in terms of my own camcorder footage for a minute on YouTube, but now I guess not. You also were involved with, told me about this other thing, this remote controlled helicopter.
Yeah. In 1996, I designed a helicopter that was supposed to be capable, it was capable, of lifting enough equipment to do searching and destroying of mines and minefields, because that's a major problem around the world. There's hundreds of millions of mines that are killing and maiming people mm-hmm. by the thousands every month. And I financed the project up to the point where I got the unit built, and then I showed it at a conference, so a demining conference, and a representative of Princess Diana, who had put $100 million into demining activities.
Yeah, I remember that.
Was going to finance the rest of it, and then she got killed, and that money went somewhere else, so that project was never finished. But I had a dealer signed up in Europe who was my dealer for my electronic things, and he was going to be the dealer for the helicopter, which we were going to sell not only for demining, but for inspecting of bridges and all kinds of applications for small.
Now you're talking how much weight could this little copter carry?
Mine originally could carry about 25 pounds, but about 2 years ago, this fellow Pietro Amati, who worked with me at Ampex 35 years ago, decided to go in the helicopter business, and he's started a company in London that now has 7 UAV helicopters, and his company is the only one in the world that has 7 different models that have a payload of from 3 pounds to 700 pounds.
Huh.
So he can lift just about any payload that's needed, and the price range of these units are about 50,000 to $1.5 million.
So they're a little bit beyond hobbyist.
But they're all UAV, which means they're computer controlled. You fly them with a computer, either a laptop or a tablet, and you don't have to be a pilot to fly them. You just tell with pointing to the screen what waypoints you want it to go to, and it goes there
so
automatically.
GPS, right? UAV, unmanned
aerial vehicle.
Yeah, that's it.
So next big thing. And just last 2 weeks ago, Congress, the House of Representatives, finally passed a bill that will free up the U.S. airspace below a certain, I think, 400 feet for police departments and for news people and for inspection of high voltage lines to be able to use these instead of full-size helicopters, which, if you notice, 2 weeks ago, San Jose Police Department said they're selling their helicopter because they can't afford the maintenance, the insurance, or the two pilots. So they're getting out of the helicopter business. And there's a lot of police departments around the world that have that same problem. And these UAV ones will do most of the job that the full-size ones will do at a fraction of the price.
And you'll have a full view for the pilot sitting in the police headquarters without having to go out.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And way less, and probably you could afford several of them.
Right.
One of the other things that struck me is that you had an app for the car that allowed you to have basically a black box recorder for potential accidents that you might have in when you're in your car.
Yeah, that's an app on the Apple App Store called iCar Black Box. It sells for 99 cents, and it converts your iPhone into a black box for your car that records video, audio, GPS, time, and it really works great. It uses the internal motion sensor of the iPhone, and you can set the sensitivity. So if your car is in an accident, it will have recorded the last 5 minutes of video and audio and GPS and speed of the accident. And I've added two things to make it work better.
Yeah,
Some hardware, not software, because the app is fine like by itself, and it's a bargain at 99 cents. But the problem is there was no mount for putting the iPhone on the windshield that worked correctly.
It's got to be in the right place to catch the action, right?
And it also can't be on a long stem. Like a lot of these iPhone holders have a 3, 5, 8-inch stem, which causes the iPhone to move around and give you false triggers. So I made a special mount that mounts the iPhone right next to the windshield, and I've added a 180-degree lens, which just snaps on the front of the iPhone.
Snaps on? You mean?
It just magnetically.
So you have a magnetic ring
there,
that you glue onto the iPhone? And
now, instead of just getting the video of the standard iPhone 35-degree wide-angle lens, you've got 180-degree, so you can see what's happening ahead and from both sides. So if you're in an accident, you've really got it covered.
You've got the last 10, what did you say, 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
I think you can set it, but you only really need the last 30 seconds or a minute of what happened before the accident.
Right. So it really is like a flight recorder.
It's like a flight recorder in an airplane, except it's video and audio and GPS and speed and everything. So.
So the thing is, when you get out into your car, instead of leaving your phone in your pocket or plugging it into your stereo system, you mount it on your windshield.
Right. You just stick it on this little holder that's on the windshield, and then if your cell phone, if it get a cell call, you can still answer the cell call. You don't even have to put it on speaker, and it'll work with any of the iPhones, the older 3 mm-hmm. or newer 4. It almost pays to buy a $49 iPhone 3 and just dedicate it to that purpose.
Yeah. Are you going to stick with the market, or are you going to eventually go into the Android world too?
We're still looking at that. I've been involved in Apple stuff since...
That's true. You've been
the
a long
Home
time
Computer
Apple.
Club in 1975.
That's
and,
true, yeah.
Yeah, so I've made many different add-ons to Apple things. You know, I know Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak from the Homebrew Computer Club. So
that's right. You were a homebrew guy yourself, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I went to the second meeting. I missed the first one, and I was at the second homebrew meeting and went through all of them all the way till the end, which was like 12 or 13 years, I think.
Wow. Folks, this is the Homebrew Computer Club was where people would gather in the Valley to talk about their latest computer projects. It was a, sort of the first real big hobbyist computer club where a lot of companies spun from the conversations and connections that happened there.
Yeah, almost all the computer companies in the Bay Area started there, including Apple and Cromemco and Processor Technology and mm-hmm. four or five other ones that I don't remember the name of, which have since gone away. But Apple's now become the second largest tech company in the world, which started right there at the Homebrew Computer Club.
Yeah.
And sometimes there'd be 200-300 people. Stanford Linear Accelerator loaned the club their big auditorium.
Yeah, it was a beautiful place. I remember
and it was great.
There. We got to take a break here for a second, Chuck. Can you hold on a second?
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. We're talking to Chuck Colby, inventor in Silicon Valley, about some of his latest inventions, as well as some reminiscences of the past.
And we'll also have some phone guests, people calling in, when we're back from the break. So stay tuned for the Doctor of Future show on KSEO 1080.
Okay, we're back with Chuck Colby, inventor in Silicon Valley, on the Dr. Future Show. You've been around since really the dawn of Silicon Valley, at least in its current era, and you've seen the computer revolution and now the mobile revolution. What do you see as coming next from your position and as an inventor there?
Well, the tablet is definitely here. It was quite a long gestation period to get it to where it is, but I think Apple's done a great job in making it kind of the standard of the world, and everybody's copying, trying to copy it. Apple's got such a lead on it, I think it's going to be really tough for a lot of these Chinese companies to get the parts, because Apple's tied up the screens and the chips and everything, but just the software that's on the iPad is so much better than anything else I've seen. I guess Android is second best, but I still think the Apple stuff is the leader of the pack.
Yeah, they're getting Samsung's getting sued by Apple now.
Yeah, I saw that in the paper. It's really interesting because Apple buys their memory chips from Samsung, so all they have to do is say, oh, you're going to sue us, we're going to cut you off.
Yeah.
But I hope that doesn't happen, because they got enough problems sourcing things from Japan because of the earthquake and all that problem over there.
Yeah. How about robotics? Do you see that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's going to be a big deal. I've got a robot in the works that is going to be out in a couple months. It'll be a telepresence robot.
Oh, yeah? How will that work?
Well, it uses the iPad, actually, as the main brains and cameras and everything.
Oh.
So it'll be a really great add-on for your iPad. And it's going to be priced at a tenth or so, or at least a fifth of what the other five major telepresence robots that are on the market are priced at. And it uses FaceTime, which is a great, great video audio. Apple put a lot of money and they did a great job developing FaceTime compared to even Skype or some of these other robots that have video systems that are just terrible.
So that's
going to be a big advantage of this unit. It'll be an add-on to your iPad.
Wow. So it can move around the room?
Yeah, you can set it in the middle of the conference table, or you can set it on top of a robot base and drive it around from anywhere in the world using another iPhone or iPad.
And clean your floor, too?
No, it doesn't do that. There's a bunch of those on the market, and that's probably best in a dedicated type machine.
Specialized robots.
Yeah.
Gotcha. What is that, in the $500 price range?
The basic unit's $500, and then the robot base with the capability to drive around is about $1,000. That'll be on the iPad and iPhone stuff.com. Mm-hmm. website when it's available.
And the advantage of that is telepresence, right? It'll allow you to remotely go to places mobily and be there.
Right, yeah, exactly. A lot of people could get away with not going into the office every day. They could go in 3 times a week or 2 times a week, and if they just had a way of being in the meeting that is decent interaction, then I think that's what this, you know, is going to provide.
Yeah, I like that. I like robots in the meeting. The way that it's going, robots are doing all the work. I think they should pay all the taxes, too. Leave
right.
the people alone.
Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, we'll let you go then. Thanks for being on the show. And what's your website for your iPad, iPhone stuff?
It's iPad and iPhone stuff.com.
Great. Thank you, Chuck, for being part of our show.
Okay, great.
All right, have a good day.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, it was Chuck Colby, Silicon Valley inventor, iPad and iPhoneStuff.com. He's created more iPhone, iPad stuff than anybody else I know. Just one idea after another comes bubbling up through his cranium. Very interesting. So check it out if you get a chance. We'll continue with a couple more news pieces and or conversations from you. If you have any ideas about inventions or ideas or any comments on what you've heard so far, please
feel
let us know.
To call in at KSCO 479-1080.
Chuck has a website called iPad and iPhone Stuff, spelled out, iPadandiPhoneStuff.com. If you have an iPad and iPhone, you might find some of the items there quite interesting. A lot of, including the teleprompter he was talking about, but also stuff for the car, cup holders, you know, for keeping your device in, headrest holder for the back seat so you can watch your iPad from the back seat. Chuck's really quite handy with hardware, especially in this area, and for creating interesting applications for the technology. My favorite is the iPad steering wheel mount, which actually allows you to mount an iPad on your steering wheel. Now, you're not supposed to do it while you're driving. It's illegal, but you can use it when you're stopped, and it'd be quite amusing. We have another very interesting thing. I have some footage up on the site of the Japan earthquake footage that you find very interesting. It's some shots taken by amateurs where it looks like the land is going sideways back and forth. It's like it's floating. It gives you a floaty sensation just watching the land do its thing. I had never seen anything like that, and I think from what I could see, there are parts of Japan that look like the land is floating. Most likely it's the land that looks a lot that's rebuilt land, the reclaimed land, the stuff from the dredgings of the harbor, stuff that we have a lot of in the Bay Area. The other element that you might find quite interesting, I put up a list of the top 5 mad scientists in the world today. It just came out. I got it from one of the mad scientists himself. He sent me this incredible article about true mad scientists today. We call them mad scientists because they're not really mad. They're not crazy or insane people, but they're people who pursue what most scientists would call pseudosciences, stuff like parapsychology, a psychic phenomenon, stuff that lacks typical plausibility. There's the top 5 list of mad scientists that I have up on the site. The number one I have met on a number of occasions, a guy named Dean Radin. The number one mad scientist is called Dean Radin. I guess we'll have to get him on the show too there. Any of you folks heard of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS? We had Kelly Durkin on here, who does all the media for IONS, last October for during her birthday week, and she told us about that, and that's in our archives. But anyway, Dean is the chief scientist there, and he's written a book called Entangled Minds, and he's written a lot of very brilliant technical articles in psychology. I never would consider him a totally mad, bad scientist. I consider him a mad good scientist or a mad glad scientist. He's spoken at over 100 lectures at Harvard, Cambridge, Stanford, Princeton, has come up with a lot of very interesting ideas for studying psychic phenomenon that are truly breakthroughs and brilliant. He's, for example, looked at the analysis of brainwaves and predicting psychic awareness.
Do you have a URL for this?
I go to the Institute of Noetic Sciences. ions.org, 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 and you can read about Dean. And he's impressed many scientists with his protocols for trying to study something that most people barely think about or understand. He's found that, for example, that it appears that we know when something is about to happen before it happens if it has a strong emotional content. Our brains or our system picks up some kind of response to a big change, like if we're going to be surprised by something or even an accident. Some parts of us seem to know about it before it actually happens, but in a way that's not linear. Like what Dean found was that people were able to predict things even before the random computer chose the thing to be chosen. You see, so we can predict even before choice is made, choice outside of ourselves. That's very mysterious, and it really shows you that space-time is stranger than we can imagine. Anyway, he's taken that on to try to understand that, and this is why he was chosen as the top mad scientist in the world at the Before It's News website, beforeitsnews.com, another interesting place to check out stories. The other video that I like to mention is that Mrs. Future and I have been working on a new YouTube series called Make Eat, Think, and Be Merry.
Make Eat, Think, and Be Merry. That's what we like to do.
Yeah.
With our friends down here in Santa Cruz.
The idea here for this series was that we would have several types of TV shows in one. We'd have like a cooking show, then we'd have an eating show. That's where you would get together with a number of interesting people and eat the food that was just cooked and talk about it, have a scintillating conversation, maybe bring in a guest from the outside world using Skype, and then be merry part of the show, which would be the entertainment.
That's right. And we have got the people to do that. If you go to our Muse Cinemedia site, we've actually just started putting these on YouTube. So if you go to youtube.com/MuseCinemedia.
Or our links page, or Dr. Future. DrFutureShow.com/links. I have a link today.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even realize
that. It has our
that,
favorite Dr. foods Future. For thought. And I put up the one that would be most interesting to talk radio, our talk radio friends, because we had another talk radio host as the Skype guest for our show, none other than pharmacist Ben Fuchs.
That's right, who has a morning show every day at, I think it's at 10 o'clock.
He's on the KOMY feed.
On the KOMY station, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, pharmacist Ben Fuchs, who has
and
a lot.
He kept us very entertained with some of his ideas.
He did.
And it's our favorite foods for thought, as the piece is called. It just went up today, and you'll have a chance to see all of us in action, including Agent Nada working behind the scenes, making sure everything is copacetic.
That's right. Making sure the cameras are on and rolling, the food is moving where it needs to go, and everybody is participating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been about a month and a half of editing and a lot of work, but we like it and we hope you do too. Please let us know. By the way, we do have a way to reach us. You can write to future@kseo.com and you'll get us.
Okay.
Be very, very nice thing. And the final thing of the day is that I mentioned it on Corey Gold's show a little bit earlier, is that there has been a quantum teleporter breakthrough, and that we finally have the first ever transfer or teleportation of quantum information from one point to another. That allows us to send quantum encryption keys and various information quantumly now. Just came in. I have just put up a piece on that.
Now, Dr. Future, these are real nice sci-fi words, but what are you telling us? What does this mean, quantum information, and what is this breakthrough?
Well, with 1 minute to go, that's going to be hard to tell to get into what quantum communications is all about. But essentially, it's a way, Schrodinger's cat. Just Google Schrodinger's cat. It was a paradox in the 20th century, and it describes a situation in which normal, classical objects can exist in quantum superposition.
Okay, that's
two states at once.
Dr. Future Show. Thank you.
More soon.
Before you know it, you're there. Living in the future in a plastic dome. Sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home. That's where I long to be, yeah. Living in the future in a plastic dome. Sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home. That's where I long to be. Now if you're hungry for food or drink, just go to the teller machine.